Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, July 8th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
So, Avi, smoking was supposed to be over.
Over.
Yeah. For decades, public health campaigns convinced millions of Americans to quit. Cigarettes disappear from restaurants, airplanes, and even movies. But lately, nicotine and smoking, well, they're having a moment. Celebrities are smoking. Cigarettes are trending on TikTok. They even have cig influencers, if you didn't know. Meanwhile, nicotine products from vaping to Zen pouches have become billion-dollar businesses. So what is happening? Is smoking and nicotine use actually making a comeback, or are we watching an old addiction reinvent itself for a new generation? We've got a couple of great guests who are going to help us figure all of this out. And of course, we would love to hear from you. Have you seen a rise in smoking and nicotine? What's your take? And if you're a new nicotine user, you can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook streamers, hello.
Hello.
Yes, you hello. Can put your comments in the live chat.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499, studio2@whyy.org. Quick note, by the way, 250 years ago on this day, first ever public reading of the Declaration of Independence,
oh,
right here,
yeah.
down the street.
Yeah, I saw
so
some of that.
So this show will be better than that.
Okay.
Before we jump into our trio of local news stories, heads up, it's another giveaway Wednesday. Every Wednesday this summer, we're giving out tickets to an upcoming event in the region. Stick around till the end of the show for the reveal of this week's Giveaway Wednesday event and your chance to win. And now, the trio of local news stories.
Mm-hmm. You're first.
Let's head up to Upper Dublin Township, Montgomery County. If you live there, you might have noticed a new gas station that opened recently. And the prices there are surprisingly low. This place is called Freedom Fuel. It's being advertised and sort of claimed by the Trump administration, although they say Freedom Fuel is a private enterprise that does not receive government support. This is a new effort. It is starting here in the Philadelphia region with 25 locations planned across the area, according to the website. So how can this Freedom Fuel sell gas for 30 to 40 cents less per gallon than nearby competitors? Well, the Inquirer says, it's kind of unclear.
Yeah.
They talked to an industry analyst who said there's no way to turn a profit at those prices. So someone is probably subsidizing this somehow. But the government says it isn't. Either way, the administration is using Freedom Fuel and its network as a talking point. On Instagram, the White House posted a video recently of happy customers at this new location in Upper Dublin. Here's a cut from that Instagram reel.
I saved money. I had to go back in and get my change. I thought gas was more expensive, but it's not. So, thanks, Trump.
So, again, we don't really know a lot here, but if you see a Freedom Fuel pop up near you in the near future, this is what we know at this point.
Yeah, I had so many questions. I saw that video on Instagram, and I was like, I had so many questions. Wanted to know where in our region it was. And, of course, now we know it's in Upper Dublin. I just wanted to go and see. I mean, anybody talking about cheaper gas, you're automatically interested. Right now, that's the only location, but you said two dozen more. I'll say this. The president had posted about this on his Truth Social for a while, saying that a retailer had stepped up to help keep gas prices down. And I think, you know, we all want cheaper gas, and we've seen prices fall at the pump after that MOU was sort of signed. Now that's not the case anymore with Iran. So we'll probably see another spike. But like you said, I mean, how is this sustainable? How is this? How could they spread this? Somebody has to eat the difference in price, because the actual price of gas is what it is.
Yeah. Cloaked in mystery.
Yes. So, yeah. I don't even know what to say.
Story number two is also about affordability. Go ahead.
Yes, it is. A new report says poverty in New Jersey is at a level that's actually three times higher than what the federal government is reporting. Yeah, the U.S. government says about 859,000 people are living below the poverty line in the Garden State. Shout out to the Inquirer for this story. But Poverty Research Institute of New Jersey, they say, hold on, feds, that number is a little or should I say severely understated. They claim the number is closer to 3 million people living below the poverty level. PRI argues that the feds undervalued the cost of living in high-cost states and fails strongly to take geography into account when calculating the poverty level. They say the cost of living in New Jersey ranks third behind only Hawaii and California. And so people are probably wondering, why is all of this important? Well, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the poverty level in the U.S. basically says you have to have make less than $25,000 a year in 2024 for a family of three to qualify for SNAP and other government benefits,
sure,
right?
Sure.
In New Jersey, where the average rent and childcare alone can run you about $40,000 a year, according to that report, even if you make $50,000 a year, you are still, you know, struggling. And that they believe that the poverty line should be higher for high, you know, cost of living states like New Jersey. You know, a lot of these families, because they can't qualify for benefits, end up at food banks and all sorts of things. And so the calculation was originally the method of calculation was created back in the 1960s. And while they have upped the level based on inflation, the method of calculation hasn't changed in decades.
It's an interesting premise. I mean, I don't know. I hadn't heard this before. Maybe it's been out there for a while. But the idea that the poverty line and different thresholds for government services mm-hmm. should change based on where you live. Makes sense. There's a logic to it for sure. I don't know exactly how you would do it in practice.
Yeah.
Should you do it by state
or city or
city geographic yeah. region? So I don't know exactly what would be the fairest way to divvy it up. But we know that the government acknowledges that cost of living is different in different places because the government's own pay scales for its own mm-hmm. employees does change based on where those people are working and living. So you might make a little more living in D.C. than you do if you have certain type of government jobs in Montana. So obviously we all and the government acknowledges that this is a reality. And I had never heard someone propose that it should be fluid based on where you live for the poverty line. But like I said, there is a clear logic to it. I don't know if it's practical, but
yeah.
there's a logic.
Because you think if the poverty line in New Jersey is $25,000, you basically it's so hard to live in New Jersey.
Right.
If the monthly rent in New Jersey is like $1,800, like
sure.
the average rent. So hard to live there. So.
All right. Story number three.
Yes.
As we get ready to wrap up this segment, let's go now to a strip mall in King of Prussia.
Mm-hmm.
There's a nail salon there. Check it out. Look at that. It's just the classic strip mall there.
Yeah.
They've got the nail salon, the UPS store, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But within the last few months, a restaurant by one of the most celebrated and mysterious Chinese American chefs in the country has opened in this strip mall. The restaurant is called Peter Chang, K-O-P.
Mm-hmm.
Philadelphia Magazine just wrote a glowing review of it, called it a dream restaurant. This guy, Peter Chang, who is behind it, is legendarily elusive. He's cooked at the Chinese embassy, dozens
wow.
of restaurants up and down the East Coast. He was profiled in the New Yorker years ago because he has this cult-like following. And now within the last year, he's opened a couple of locations of his expanding empire here
Very
in Philadelphia.
Cool.
One in King of Prussia, which we just showed you. Another bigger spot called Mama Chang's, which is out closer to Lansdale. I love a good backstory
mm-hmm.
when it comes to a restaurant. And this backstory, I did not know about this guy, Peter Chang. This has been a thing for decades,
yeah,
apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
Peter Chang, the hype around Peter Chang. So now I want to go to Peter Chang's KOP.
And let me tell you, he's a mystery that's everywhere but nowhere at all, which
Ooh.
Makes you want to kind of check out his food.
But I would watch a movie about him based on that description.
And I went on the Peter Chang KOP website and almost placed an order for pickup, okay? I will tell you that because of the prices, so affordable.
Get out of here.
So very affordable.
What were the prices?
You could get stuff for like $20.
Interesting.
Some stuff even less. And then, of course, they do still have high-end things. Like
sure.
if you want a whole duck, it's going to cost
more
you.
More than $20.
But that's
yeah.
not what most people get. And so it's very affordable. I mean, even the Philly Mag story had a $1 sign.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, you get top shelf chef, right, in King of Prussia. Very affordable. And I was like, how can I get the King of Prussia to come back real quick? So that DoorDash it.
There's a problem with
King
of Prussia. You got to drive there.
It's
a bear.
It's a bear. But I mean, it's very affordable. And it made me want to check it out
for that
reason.
What's your favorite Chinese American dish?
Well,
do you have a go-to?
I don't necessarily have a go-to. Sometimes I like, you know, any kind of chicken, right. I'll go with it.
Yeah.
Or shrimp fried rice, something like that. But I mean, there were things on there that I would be willing to try just because it's him.
Absolutely.
So Peter Chang, especially at that price.
Peter Chang, KOP, we are officially intrigued.
Yeah.
We are also intrigued, maybe a little concerned about the trends around smoking in this country. And Absolutely. It's a little bit difficult to sort of put it all into one synopsis because smoking rates are very, very low, historically low. But there's also been, on the culture front, this seeming resurgence in interest, in coolness surrounding smoking. We're going to talk about that on the other side of this break, and also some of the new era, new age nicotine products that are catching on in this country. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Smoking rates are at a historic low. And yet, recently, it feels like it's all over pop culture. Superstars like Beyonce and Sabrina Carpenter are posing with cigarettes, and smoky scenes are all over hit TV shows like The Bear and Euphoria.
Meanwhile, nicotine in the form of next-gen products like vapes and pouches are gaining popularity as the FDA loosens regulations. And influencers like Joe Rogan and Tucker Carlson are beating the drum for their favorite products. Here's Carlson in a recent interview on the subject.
Nicotine's super important. This country's gotten far sadder and less healthy since it was discouraged, and it's coming back. And I think it shows, like, people are just happier.
Yeah, today, is nicotine having a renaissance? What does the science say about the health and addiction impacts of the various products, and how is public perception evolving?
Let me introduce our guest for the hour. Sarah Todd is a reporter for STAT, a health and medicine news site. Sarah, thank you for being here on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Let's also welcome Stephanie Gratali, assistant professor at the Rutgers School of Public Health and the Rutgers Institute for Nicotine and Tobacco Studies. Stephanie, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, and listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Have you seen a rise in smoking and nicotine? What's your take? And if you're a new nicotine or new smoker, we'd love to hear from you as well. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can leave your comments in the live chat. And Sarah, wanted to sort of start with you because you're a journalist, a reporter, you've been covering this issue. When did you first realize that nicotine and cigarettes may somehow be back in fashion?
So I think to me, really, it kind of coincided with the rise of MAHA, the Make America Healthy Again movement, and a lot of the interest in counterintuitive types of approaches to health that includes raw milk and eating red meat. And I think that some of the interest in nicotine kind of goes hand in hand with those types of ideas.
And so what was sort of like the messaging that you started to see that made you say, huh, this could be a thing?
So there are a lot of different influencers, whether people who are sort of in the manosphere podcast world, like Joe Rogan and Andrew Huberman, Dave Asprey, who's a famous biohacker, he was the inventor of the bulletproof coffee. All of them started expressing interest in nicotine as a kind of supplement to add to your stack that could enhance the clarity of your thinking or give you an energy boost before your workout, all of these types of ideas. So that was one big tip off. We mentioned earlier, Tucker Carlson, of course, Carlson has his Alps brand of pouches. And Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the health secretary, was spotted appearing to pop a nicotine pouch during his confirmation hearing as well.
Okay, wow. So there's kind of two tracks here. One is maybe the resurgent popularity of nicotine and these new age nicotine delivery vehicles like a pouch. Then there's smoking, right? And so I think we should be clear, right? Like, the percentage of Americans who smoke is historically low from what I understand, Stephanie. But there's some anecdotal, maybe anecdata evidence out there that there's at least cultural interest in smoking, or the idea that smoking makes you look cool. We talked about some of the pop stars, some of the TV shows. I'll read this stat that was reported in The Guardian. The public health nonprofit Truth Initiative's Lights camera tobacco report found that tobacco depictions in the 15 most popular streaming shows among 15 to 24-year-olds rose by 110% between 2021 and 2022. It's sort of a small data set there. I don't know how much it means, but do you think there is something to this idea that smoking might have some renewed interest around it?
I do think so. I think it's, I look at it kind of like a perfect storm of a few different types of factors. So on the one hand, there are these kind of normative influences that we've been talking about, things you see on social media, celebrities, depictions on popular shows. And then there's also the communications factor where you had for years campaigns that were targeting things like e-cigarettes and their harms. And so people who are adolescents now or the younger side of young adults grew up with anti-e-cig campaigns rather than cigarette campaigns. And then you also have these policy factors where you have states regulating e-cigs and other products as they, you know, should, as you totally understand, but you have this focus that shifted away from cigarettes because the rates had dropped so significantly that it kind of seems to have created a little opening for them to gain popularity again. And it feels like there's a bit of a changing dynamic, like a shift in the tides, and you're not seeing these overwhelming waves of, you know, young people now smoking cigarettes, but what you are seeing are trends in data where in certain places, for instance, where there are stronger efforts against e-cigarettes, you are seeing small upticks in young people using cigarettes. So I do think it's not like a massive resurgence, but it feels like something is shifting culturally and you're starting to see it bear out in little ways in empirical data.
Yeah. One of the things that we read about in preparing for the show is that this administration has sort of made it also a little bit easier for, you know, tobacco companies and nicotine companies to sort of promote their products, sell their products more openly with less regulation. Stephanie, does that ring true in some of the work that you've been doing and some of the data that you've been seeing?
So I think from the regulatory standpoint, the really big kind of piece of news that was a change was that recently for the first time, there was authorization of certain fruit flavored e-cigarettes. And it wasn't like wide scale authorization. It was a particular brand. And it does work like that in terms of flavored products, but that hadn't happened before. And the concern there is that the fruit flavored products historically are known to attract young people. So that's a bit of a regulatory shift, but it does get at this larger and valid debate, even within the tobacco control and regulatory science sphere of, you know, harm reduction from e-cigarettes versus the potential of attracting new users to nicotine products, particularly young people who otherwise might not have been. And there are, you know, valid points on both sides, but it's really about trying to find a way to offer a tool that can help people who are addicted to cigarettes and the most harmful combusted tobacco products, and trying to minimize or mitigate the risks to young people who might not otherwise use them.
Yeah, let's get into that debate in a second. I do want to read this comment from Shannon, who says, I was a smoker for years and years, and it took a heart attack to get me to quit. My kids spent years and years trying to get me to quit, and now two of the three vape regularly. Now I'm the one begging them to quit. If you want to add your voice, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. I really like that comment from Shannon because it gets us into this conversation about, from a public health perspective, what should we be endorsing and boosting, and what should we be regulating and suppressing? So let's just establish, I guess, some of the health facts here, Sarah. Cigarettes, smoking cigarettes, your pack of Marlboros, that's the worst, right? You can't really do worse than that from a health perspective, right?
Right. We know that that's associated with lung cancer, other kinds of cancer, cardiovascular disease, all kinds of fatal illnesses.
Now we go to e-cigarettes, and then we go to the nicotine pouches. In terms of the health effects, give us an overview of what we know about the e-cigarettes versus cigarettes, and then the pouches versus e-cigarettes and cigarettes.
Sure. And I'll preface this by saying, Stephanie, please jump in at any point. My understanding from speaking with researchers is that these risks all exist on a continuum. Compared to cigarettes, e-cigarettes are going to be less likely to give you these kind of, fatal terminal chronic diseases that we were talking about. Same with nicotine pouches. However, since they're also both newer products, we have less longitudinal data that can tell us exactly what the health risks are. Some of the answers to the questions are like, we don't totally know. So one of the concerns are the contaminants that might be included in these products that could be carcinogenic as well.
So that when we talk about this continuum idea, it's so fascinating, right? Because if I take someone and their starting point is they're a smoker, they smoke a pack a day, what I want to do is get them on anything else. Ideally, not doing anything, but if I can get them from smoking a pack a day to doing the equivalent of e-cigarettes, that's a win, right, Stephanie? But the continuum can go the other way, which is someone starts with e-cigarettes and then moves to cigarettes. Is that the basic dynamic? Do I have that right, Stephanie?
Yeah, absolutely. So, if you've tried an e-cigarette, if you've smoked or used e-cigarettes regularly, you are at an increased risk of smoking in the future. That by no means signifies that everyone who uses e-cigarettes will turn to smoke. Most of young e-cigarette users do not currently smoke, but there absolutely is an increased risk.
I wanted to interject here a little bit, Stephanie, because I wanted to talk about nicotine. I mean, Sarah talked about some of these influencers, even the Health and Human Services Secretary using the pouches. And people have said that there are some positive effects of nicotine. What does nicotine actually do? Because we understand smoking is bad, right? E-cigarettes, a little bit better, but still bad. And then nicotine, just the pouches, bad, but better than e-cigarettes and smoking. But what does nicotine itself do? Are there any positive implications for using it such that you should separate it out as a substance?
So I think in general, the science and public health recommendations are that you should not start using a nicotine product or any sort of nicotine or tobacco product if you don't already use one, so that the function of something like an e-cig or a nicotine pouch is really about offering reduced risk to someone who's already using something less harmful. If you're looking at just the nicotine itself, as Sarah said, we don't have decades of research about the long-term effects of a pouch or of e-cigarettes the way we do for traditional cigarettes. But the most, obvious, very strong risk is addiction. Nicotine is an addictive chemical, and so once you start using any nicotine product, you are more likely to escalate to other products, which and to essentially move up on the harm scale. Beyond that, when you think about nicotine itself, beyond just addiction, it has negative effects on particularly the developing brain. So when you're talking about youth and adolescents, when you're talking about even young adults whose brains are still developing, there are negative effects of nicotine. Beyond just addiction, there are things like effects on attention and other factors. And then, of course, all of these products are harmful, to more vulnerable populations such as pregnant women and people who already have other health issues.
When you talked about the addictive qualities of nicotine, some people might hear that and think that sounds like caffeine. Sort of you get hooked on it and your brain maybe re-regulates based on the amount of caffeine you intake in a certain day. But, to the average person would tell you, well, caffeine itself doesn't feel harmful to me. It's just that I kind of need it to maintain my baseline functions. Stephanie, can you just put nicotine and caffeine side by side for us and tell us about the similarities and the differences?
I don't know that I'm 100% qualified
Sure.
to answer that, like the science of caffeine versus the nicotine and addiction. But what I will say is that I'm not personally familiar with a wide swath of studies indicating the harms of caffeine. I know it can have some effects on calcium, and potentially some say it affects your
Sure.
bone, right? But with nicotine, there are studies indicating that it hurts developing brains. I
Got
think
it.
that's a really important distinction. It can disrupt things like the formation of brain circuits that control attention, learning, and that it can just make young people more susceptible to nicotine, like addiction. The exposure to nicotine makes you more susceptible to addiction and to escalation to other products. And even the switch from a pouch to an e-cigarette, both types of products that are available in appealing flavors to young people, that represents a progression in harm because e-cigarettes have like a ton of chemicals that some are probably carcinogenic, not to the level of cigarettes, but it's still harmful.
Interesting. Okay, so we're gonna go to a break now. I'm gonna continue this conversation about nicotine, tobacco, and where we seem to be heading from a public health perspective. Our guests this hour are Sarah Todd, a reporter for STAT, a health and medicine news site, and Stephanie Grittali, assistant professor at the Rutgers School of Public Health and the Rutgers Institute for Nicotine and Tobacco Studies. We'd love to hear from you. Have you seen, do you sense a rise in smoking and nicotine use? What's your take? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you are on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Before we jump back into our conversation about nicotine and smoking, it is time to reveal today's giveaway Wednesday event. Al Banks, hit it.
Life is sad. Life is a bust. All you can do is do what you must. You do what you must do.
And that is Joan Osborne covering Bob Dylan. The If God Was One of Us singer will be doing a full set of Dylan covers on Friday, August 7th in King of Prussia as part of the Concerts Under the Stars series.
Yeah, two tickets to the show will run you $80. But the first person who emails studio2@whyy.org and asks for a pair will get them free courtesy of Studio 2. Again, that email is studio2@whyy.org.
Do you have to ask nicely? You can just say, give them to me.
Give them to
Just I give think, me.
Tickets.
Tickets. Yeah,
ticks,
that's probably
whatever,
all you need. I don't know.
Put it in the subject line.
All right, now back to our conversation about the rise of smokeless nicotine products and why they seem to be slipping into the mainstream, plus what we know about their health effects. Let me reintroduce our guests. Sarah Todd is a reporter for Stat News, a health and medicine outlet. And Stephanie Grittali is an assistant professor at the Rutgers School of Public Health and the Rutgers Institute for Nicotine and Tobacco Studies.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Have you seen a rise in smoking and nicotine? What's your take? If you're a new smoker or a nicotine user, love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And our Facebook and YouTube streamers, keep those comments coming on the live chat. NYC215 on YouTube says they made smoking look appealing. It started with the Juul pods. I remember everyone smoking it and trading refills. It looked appealing too because of the design. It became a trend for many.
Let me ask you actually, Sarah Todd, what's the trend line right now on the e-cigarettes, the Juuls? Like that was a big talking point. It was a very buzzy thing. I remember, you know, several years back. Has it kind of plateaued? Or what are the trends with young people? Like what do we know? Where do we seem to be heading when it comes to vaping, e-cigarette use?
Yeah, so as you remember, you know, with the popularity of Juul and other flavored vapes, the crisis really peaked around 2019 when there were really large portions of teenagers who were using e-cigarettes, and rightly so, there was a lot of attention to this problem. Since then, thanks to a combination of factors, including the pandemic, the fact that the age at which you can legally purchase tobacco products was raised from 18 to 21, we've seen the numbers fall again for young people's use of e-cigarettes, which is great news. But of course, there's still more work to be done. There's still, you know, the most popular way of consuming nicotine among young people.
Yeah. And can we talk about pop culture influence? I watch Euphoria And of course, in that show, you do see the characters on the show smoking. You see characters on different shows smoking a lot more than maybe you would have seen like 5 or 6 years ago, right? And so how does this, just watching like young people or just anyone watching folks consume tobacco in that way or vape or whatever, how does that influence people's adoption of nicotine or smoking? And I'll start with you, Sarah, and love to get your take as well, Stephanie.
Yeah, we know that there really is a direct relationship between watching movies and TV shows and celebrities smoke and adoption of rates among young people who are, of course, easily influenced, looking up to these people. The Surgeon General's report in 2019 found, you know, there's a clear association. And it's also interesting, tobacco use is common even in movies that are rated G and PG too. You know, it's really prevalent everywhere. So it's something to look out for. Kids will do whatever seems to be cool. A lot of the time it's being used in the context of people appearing sort of rebellious. And, you know, that's something that we know that a lot of teenagers are very interested in being and countercultural. So there's a lot of appeal there.
Yeah. And Stephanie, love to give you your take, because a lot of millennials grew up, right? And Gen X and millennials grew up with the being hit over the head with the don't smoke.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and oh, you see, yeah. You remember the commercials.
Scary.
The lady with the trach telling you this is, you know, and so, and now you have Gen Z. They're not necessarily bombarded like we were. And yet you're seeing it in pop culture. Just the collision of those two factors and its influence on the next generation. Stephanie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think very much like Sarah said, there is a modeling effect. And I just think it's really a normative influence. So it's the behavior is becoming normalized. It's seeming like something that more people are doing, which I think in some ways helps to erode the sense of harm. But I think it's also just in conjunction with other messaging about other types of products. And I think this lack of focus on cigarettes has helped sort of open up this doorway. It's this sense of like, what's old is new again. So the way
it's almost like vinyl or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's retro. It's starting to become cool again. And I think it has weirdly almost oppositional roots in different cultural aspects. So on the one side, I think there's this, you know, there are people who think that that they're less harmful than e-cigarettes, for example. So among young people, data are showing that the number who think that cigarettes are more harmful has dropped precipitously. And the number who think that they're equally as harmful or that e-cigs are worse than cigarettes is actually significantly increasing. So that's obviously an incorrect perception, but you can understand where that's coming from. And in part, I do think that there was such an emphasis on the chemicals in e-cigarettes. Like I remember these commercials that almost personified the chemicals as monsters. And so it kind of portrayed it as this idea of like this big, bad, unnatural thing. And so the, you know, kind of counterpoint to that is like, well, smoking comes from a tobacco plant. And now you even have tobacco cigarette varieties that are listed as organic and additive free and have beautiful scenes of nature on their packs and in their ads.
So you're like, it's from the earth.
Yeah, you know? That's interesting.
Yeah, exactly. There's an association with the natural. And then on the flip side, I've also read that for some young people, this idea of cigarettes as coolness and rebellion, and it's a bit of a reaction against wellness culture that they feel bombarded with. So it's like these two opposite forces that somehow both could contribute to, you know, little upticks in renewed interest towards cigarettes.
I would love to hear from you this hour. Our number, 888-477-9499. Our email, studio2@whyy.org. Have you seen a rise in smoking and nicotine use? What's your take? Are you a new nicotine user? Are you trying to quit? 888-477-9499. Speaking of quitting, Clifton says, I was a smoker since the age of 18 until 4 years ago. That's about 26 years. Quitting was the best thing I ever did. MJ says, I quit smoking 25 years ago, and I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be here today if I hadn't quit. Talking about messaging, there was this, and I guess there still is, the CDC Office on Smoking and Health. And it sort of seems to be in a limbo state from what I was reading. It was shut down, and then maybe they're trying to bring some of the workers back. Many of our listeners remember there were these broad attempts to reduce the size of the federal government in the early days of the Trump administration. First of all, so Sarah, tell me about the CDC Office on Smoking and Health. What did it do, and what is its status right now? Can you tell us the latest there?
Sure. Yeah. So the Office of Smoking and Health at the CDC was responsible for a bunch of different programs. One of the things that they're best known for are the quitting commercials from former smokers that were really widely seen and very effective, where people would share their stories, often, you know, in the later stages of disease and illness. They also work with state programs, providing a lot of funding and structure and guidance to their programs for helping people quit smoking as well. They worked on the Surgeon General's report and the National Youth Tobacco Survey. So a bunch of different types of things that they do. The status right now, as you were saying, they were effectively shuttered under the new Trump administration, and its status is still in limbo. But for now, we effectively don't have an Office of Smoking and Health at the moment. And, you know, there was just a story recently, I believe in the New York Times, about how calls to state quit lines have fallen significantly in the aftermath. And they're tying that to the fact that these tips from former smokers, that those commercials from real people who had smoked, those are now no longer being produced, no longer on the air. And that was really tied to people being inspired to make the calls to quit lines. So we are seeing a correlation between, you know, the end of the Office of Smoking and Health and what it's doing for quitters.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting, because it seems like when you see the commercial, you make the call, you try to get off the soft. Let's see if we can bring in a caller. We have Julia from Bucks County on the line. Julia, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I'm a student, and I've seen the rise in like the smoking usage, and I see it as a lot of more like a self-harm, because a lot of the kids that I know that smoke, they're like, well, yeah, we know it's bad, but like, it's like, we're going to die early anyway. So it's like, I want to die.
Nihilism.
I find that something that it's not really talked about.
Yeah. Interesting comment from Julia in Bucks County.
And Stephanie,
thank you, Julia.
Thank you, Julia, for sharing that. Again, our number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We'd love to get your take. Have you seen a rise in smoking and nicotine? If you're, you know, a nicotine or, you know, smoker, we'd love to hear from you. If you're trying to quit as well, we'd love to hear from you. Again, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Stephanie, would love to get your response to that. What Julia had to say. I mean, you know, just the idea that, you know what do we have to lose? We're not going to live anyway. What are some of the reasons why you've been hearing that some of the younger people are sort of taking on the habit?
Yeah, so the perspective that Julia just shared, I have read about, and kind of, again, in line with that reaction to wellness culture, and sort of like, there's so much happening in the world, people feel like the world is burning. And so it is a sense, unfortunately, of like a little bit of hopelessness. So I think they think like, what's this cigarette really gonna do? What's our world gonna look like in 40, 50, 60 years anyway? So I think that's one piece of it. And I think, you know, the world is a little tough for young people right now. Like I compare it to even when I came out of, you know, college or grad school, you know, it's hard for them. It's hard for them professionally. And there are just a lot of heavy things going on. And I think in general, like when you also combine that with the fact that, you know, mental health struggles are a lot more common and a lot more diagnosed, at least, and documented in young people today, that I think it's, does play into this, you know, factor of like, you know what, I'm just going to do what I'm going to do now. And it, you know, it is unfortunate to see young people going through that.
Let me bring in another caller. This is John from Bucks County. Mm-hmm. We're staying in Bucks County here. Yeah. John, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. My comment is several decades ago, when John Wayne died of lung cancer, Hollywood made a real effort to stop glamorizing smoking. And until that point, they definitely did. If you watch older movies, Casablanca, everybody's constantly mm-hmm. smoking. And for decades, you did not see a lot of smoking in movies or TV shows. And it seems to be having a resurgence where I'm watching a lot of characters in movies and TV shows now who are smoking again. And I think it glamorizes it again, once again.
Thank you, John. Thank you for that comment. Nolan on YouTube says smoking is evil. Not only does it damage the human body and smell bad, it also pollutes the air for non-smokers, and many smokers leave their cigarette butts all over the roadside. They are litter bugs. Thank you, Nolan, for that comment. You know, when it came to regulating cigarettes, Sarah, it seemed like there was, you can make the argument a couple of ways. One, it's bad for people, but two, it affects the other people around the smoker. So that became a real sort of easy
smoke. Yeah.
It's an MO to grab onto to get rid of it in restaurants and airplanes and make it essentially very inconvenient to smoke. When you talk about, let's say that the pouches, the Zyn pouches, it's a little harder to make the health case, although there are health effects, but the health effects are not as severe. And you can't make the it affects the other people argument if you're trying to regulate. Do you think that's going to make it harder to create a regulatory framework that's effective around the Zyn pouches and the other nicotine pouches?
You know, that's a really good point. And yeah, I do think that part of the reason why the regulation against cigarettes was able to gain so much public support was because it affected so many people, you know, non-smokers who didn't want to be seated in, you know, inside a restaurant with people who were smoking, people who were really worried about the welfare of kids who might share a household with people who smoked. And we do see some more upscale battles when it comes to figuring out what the argument is going to be for regulating nicotine pouches. I think also, you know, even more recently, just the other week, the FDA authorized Zyn to make the marketing claim that it is lower risk compared to cigarettes. That's not necessarily something that I think that a lot of researchers would dispute, especially those who support harm reduction. However, it is another win for tobacco companies who are really betting on smokeless tobacco products as part of their future. They know that in the U.S., cigarette smoking rates are going way down, and they're really betting on nicotine pouches and e-cigarettes as the way forward.
And on that point, Stephanie, what is the best way forward when it comes to the pouches? Like, because like we just mentioned, there's this harm reduction argument of like, we should make these widely available because the people who smoke could really benefit from access to nicotine in a different vehicle, different mechanism. But at the same time, we're worried about this slippery slope of you start with the pouches, then you move on to cigarettes. Like, I don't even know, what should the regulatory framework be? Should we be making them, taxing them really heavily to make them really expensive like we do with cigarettes? Or should we do the opposite and make them cheaper than cigarettes so that people can get off cigarettes? What would be your suggestion, Stephanie?
I don't think there's sort of a silver bullet or a one-size-fits-all answer to this. And I think it's also important to remember that regulation is one piece of the picture, and that regulation also exists on a number of different levels. So for instance, with flavored e-cigarettes, we saw, you know, the federal government just authorized, as I mentioned earlier, some additional varieties of e-cigarettes, including some fruit-flavored ones. But then you have states that have completely banned all flavored e-cigarettes. There's, you know, close to 10, not quite 10 states yet. And so there are many debates about what the right approach is. And I don't think there's one clear answer. What makes it so tricky is that a lot of research is focused on a specific product. So looking at pouches now, we're looking at e-cigs, and it's a complex marketplace. And there are so many different products, more products now than there ever have been. And so regulation strategies, communication strategies that focus specifically on one product can have unintended effects on other products. So what I mentioned before about some small upticks in in cigarette use in states that have stronger e-cig regulations, that's a horrible unintended effect. Even at a small number, even a small percentage shifting, that is the worst possible unintended effect to have a policy that leads to more young people smoking. That doesn't mean we shouldn't regulate e-cigarettes. It just means that I think policies need to be considered really more holistically. And I think we also have to consider the communication that goes along with them from public health organizations, government organizations, because the messaging is an important piece of it too. Their products like e-cigarettes and pouches may have a role in reducing morbidity and mortality from tobacco use, but they are very harmful for young people, and they're not something we want non-nicotine and tobacco users to start using. So it is a tricky balancing act, and I don't have the answer. I just think there needs to be more research, and there needs to be very intentional messaging around the product and around the regulation.
Yeah, Justine on Facebook says, cigarettes are so expensive now. No one can afford to smoke anymore. And Dale says, I don't know how anyone can afford to smoke cigarettes when the price a one pack in Philadelphia is like $14. I wanted to sort of talk about the idea, you know, that when I started the show, we thought, you know, smoking was basically dead. You know, that, you know, you go around, you can't smoke in most places, very few places except for casinos, right? That you really can openly smoke. And so I think, you know, in the United States, when you feel like something, the problem is solved, you kind of start rolling back regulations, you stop talking about it, you stop the education campaign. And this is sort of the anecdotal rise or backslide, so to speak. I just wonder your thoughts in your reporting, Sarah, of covering different health issues, medical issues, when you see the rollback or the complacence, right? The complacency, like, oh, we've solved this problem. Look at the smoking rates. Look at the use rates. It's so low. What tends to happen when you feel that way, when the government sort of reacts that way, when lawmakers react that way?
Yeah, I think that this is what, you know, researchers are really worried about, is that, you know, we're taking our eye off the ball. We're getting more accustomed to the idea that people are past smoking, but, you know, it's still the number one cause of preventable death and disease in the U.S. It's a huge problem. It affects millions of Americans. So very much, even though it's below 10% for the first time since we started tracking that, 10% of Americans is a lot of people. And that's something that we need to be doing everything that we can to help people quit and to prevent young people from starting to use it. And the other thing that I would say about, you know, some of this indeed is getting complacent as rates fall. But then I think that, you know, a lot of critics have said that under this new administration, there have been some active steps that have been taken that have been friendly to tobacco companies, whether that's things like, you know, loosening restrictions on flavored vapes, so that they've said that they're not going to crack down on flavored vapes so long as they've submitted some sufficient data. They've said that they are, you know, like endorsing Zyn as less harmful than cigarettes. So there are all these different ways. And then, of course, there's the Office of Smoking and Health. So there are all these different ways that we're sort of seeing proactive steps being taken that wind up supporting tobacco companies marketing their products.
Yeah. As we get ready to wind down the hour, let's bring in another caller. Mm-hmm. This is somehow another caller from Bucks County. It's Amy from Bucks County.
Bucks has been represented
Amy, hope
today.
Everything is great in Bucks County. Would love to hear your perspective on Studio 2. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Hello, everybody. Yeah, I was just sharing that I was what I would call a casual smoker when I was young. Like I was that girl at the party who would bum cigarettes from people. Yeah. Like I wasn't like, you know, the annoying one, but I haven't smoked in years. And I was just sharing that I was watching Peaky Blinders and I'm like, oh my gosh, I want a cigarette.
Because they were smoking in the show.
Yeah, and I was like, and it wasn't glamorous. I wouldn't call it glamorous because Peaky Blinders is pretty tough for folks in your audience who know the show. But it's, you know, it's a period piece, right?
Yeah.
But I said to my husband, I'm like, holy cow, I want a cigarette.
Yeah. It got into your subconscious.
Reminds me, thanks for the call, Amy. Someone, I can't remember who on our team, was like, the reason that cigarettes are cool again is because of Mad Men. That was their reference. And that's a period
piece, right?
They
were smoking
right?
a lot of cigarettes in that
but
show.
Now, that said, as we ran out the hour, there's been some pessimism, right? But I do feel like we should situate America versus like the European countries when it comes to the rates of smoking. Like, we are doing some things pretty well, right, Stephanie, in terms of getting people to quit smoking or never start? Like, can you situate America versus peer countries as we have about a minute left before the show wraps?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing that's great, and you started off the hour by talking about this, our smoking rates are at historic lows. That is so important. And the rates among young people have come down so much. That is also so important. And I think it's just important to remember the big picture, right? So we have made tremendous strides, but then we also have tremendous challenges, because one thing you have to give the tobacco industry credit for, they are amazing at marketing new products and existing products. They are extremely clever. And so as the industry adapts, we need to adapt too, in terms of our regulations, in terms of our communication strategies, and in terms of our normative messaging. So we can also be creative in terms of, like, you know, ambassadors for our own, you know, for kind of the not smoking cause as well. And so there have been gains, but there's more work to be done.
Yeah. Well, thank you for helping us do some of that work this hour. That was Stephanie Grittali, assistant professor at the Rutgers School of Public Health and the Rutgers Institute for Nicotine and Tobacco Studies. Stephanie, thanks for your time today on Studio 2. And thank you, Sarah Todd, a reporter for Stat News, a health and medicine outlet. Sarah, so appreciate your insights on Studio 2 this hour.
Got to read this comment from Linda, who says, I grew up with smoking, often being exposed to puffs of smoke in public places. Even if it seems like it's not as much of an issue anymore, doesn't mean we should stop regulating it. Thanks so much for that comment, Linda. And thanks so much to our callers and everybody who wrote in today. And of course, can't end the show without saying thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, Paige Murray Bessler, and Ben Abrams. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2, here at WHYY, I'm Cherry Grant.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We'll talk to you tomorrow.